From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Ira Glass of the program This American Life came into public radio sort of backward. He was looking for a summer internship, and he got a tip from a friend about this radio network called NPR. Ira didn't know what NPR was at the time, but he had a little experience with radio. As a teenager, he had actually written some jokes for a DJ's morning show, so he figured, why not? But at some point early on in the experience, he says he heard a story that seemed to make all the difference. Up until that point, he hadn't really heard anything good on the radio.
And there was just something about it. I thought, like, I have never heard anything like this. I don't know what this is, but I want to do this.
Ira Glass is coming to Salt Lake this week, which gave us an excuse to talk to him. And we will, after this.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Ira Glass is coming to Salt Lake on Friday. He's going to be at Kingsbury Hall talking about, well, we're not entirely sure. Radio, of course, and storytelling, of course. But you never know. He could dance. He has before on stage. Or he could make balloon animals. He's done that too. Anyway, the event gave us an opportunity to talk to Ira. On Friday, we spoke with him, and I began by congratulating him on his latest Peabody Award. He had been asked to go on the CBS Morning News to talk about the Peabodys. He's hosting the award ceremony this year. And when he went on the TV show, he didn't know he had won. The reporter, Charlene Hunter-Galt, who was there with him on the show, decided to surprise him. Here, I'll let Ira tell the story.
And so I'm on live TV, and the day before they sent a list of the winners to me. So, you know, I would be able to say, like, and, you know, talk about the winners.
Yeah.
And This American Life, we entered this show this year. We did two episodes on this high school called Harper High School, which had 29 shootings in 1 year. And truthfully, we really hoped to win.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm not sure we've ever done anything better than those 2 hours. I felt like, and it was sending three reporters into a high school for 5 months. It was a huge investment of time and energy. And I felt like we were reporting on something no one had really reported on, which is like, what is life like in a school like that? And what can we learn from what they're going through in a school where there's so much shootings? And we weren't on the list. We hadn't won. Like, I was just like, oh no, we lost. And I was so disappointed. And also then, maybe this is bad to say, but I was so like upset of like, oh no, now I'm going to have to go on TV and like announce the winners. And like, and then, and also like partly they like, and you have to talk about how wonderful the Peabody Awards are. And know, this important tradition and how important it is to win. And then I'm just like, and I'm flashing forward to like, and then I'm going to be hosting the awards, going to be the public face of the awards. And I hate them.
Yes, yeah, so the fourth winner is for Excellence in Radio. Who's that
Excellence
winner?
In Radio. Now let's find. Oh, congratulations, Harper High School! You did it. The most amazing.
And then when Charlene Hunter-Galt reveals that you in fact had one. That,
yes. Yeah. No. I was really stunned.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. I got punked.
He got punked
by this legendary journalist, yeah. Charlene Hunter-Galt. On national television.
Yeah.
She took time out from her busy schedule of like writing about her personal friendship with Nelson Mandela to punk me on national TV.
So congratulations, Ira Glass, the fifth winner.
Surprise,
wow.
Surprise.
Yeah.
Okay. I know you look
That's
a little
amazing.
Stunned.
Yeah.
But you must be really, obviously you are proud of that story. Just say something about the beginnings, because you've talked about Julie Snyder who kind of got the ball rolling, wanted to find a way to, cover gun violence in Chicago.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes this is something I talk about on stage that I was thinking about talking about when I'm out there in Salt Lake. But basically, yeah, Julie, our senior producer, wanted to cover this thing that was happening in Chicago, that the 506 people were shot in 1 year, were shot and killed in 1 year in Chicago, and the number was going up. And other media was covering this, like, throughout that year, of just like, this is really a lot of people dying. And it's weird now for in a big city for the number to go up. In most big cities, it either is stable or going down. And Julie just had this question, but she's just like, first of all, we should try to cover this because it seems like it's important. But also, she's just like, why are people shooting each other? You read the accounts and it'll just be like, you know, a man at a gas station at the corner of 76 and Stony Island. And it's just like, but what was it? Like, yeah. was it a domestic dispute? Was it a drug deal gone bad? Like, what are these shootings? And we ran at it a couple of different ways. And the first way we ran at it, she's just like, well, on Memorial Day weekend of that year, over 50 people were killed. 50 people in 1 3-day weekend. And Julie was just like, okay, well, that's it. We'll just do these 50 people. And we're just going to look into it and explain, like, what were these 50 shootings about? And then we launched in, and Ben Calhoun, one of our producers on staff, and Alex Kotlowitz, one of the reporters who we work with, started, like, looking into, like, what are these shootings? And we realized after a few weeks, like, that is an impossible story to report in the timeline we wanted to, because the cases that were going to court, you know, where they were prosecuting people, those cases, like, nobody can talk because it's going to go to court. Like, you know, the lawyers just tell everybody, don't talk to anybody. Like, don't mess up any evidence and don't – you know what I mean? Like, you can't talk before a trial. And so we couldn't get anybody to say anything on the radio, which is, you know, bad. And then the other cases that weren't going to court, it was a sort of thing where, like, you know, you phone up somebody on the west side of Chicago, you know, and you say, like, okay, so your uncle got shot over Memorial Day weekend. Like, can you tell me anything about that? And you're from, like, a radio station that they've never heard of. Yeah. Like, you're a stranger on the phone being like, what do you know about this murder? And so generally, like, people would just hang up on us. And so, like, that, like, it just turned out, like, you could report this out, but you'd have to spend months. You know what I mean? Like, we wouldn't be in the air with it for a year and a half, you know, like, and or 2 years. And we're just like, okay, we got to find something else. And then on our local public radio station on WBEZ, this reporter, Linda Lutton, just went to the funeral of the latest shooting victim, a girl named Shikaki Aspi. And at the funeral, she interviewed the principal of the high school that Shikaki went to. And the principal was this incredibly smart, full of feeling lady who had really interesting thoughts about all of the shootings. And she had brought with her to the funeral this notebook that she had been making with a list of all the kids who had been shot in 1 year. And I think at that point it was 27 kids. And she read the names and talked about, you know, like, how many kids are getting shot in her school. And we heard that story and we're just like, oh, let's do that. Let's go there.
I need us to begin to quiet down.
Sitting all together in a group of the freshmen, looking the way the freshmen do on the first day of school, like they barely know who they are.
The class of 2016, where you at? The class of 2016, where you at?
Down in front, sitting together, are the seniors, looking the way seniors do on the first day of school.
And then my babies are here. My class of 2013, where you at?
The program is one-third pep rally, two-thirds business, introductions and rules. Exactly the kind of first day stuff you would expect at any school. Till it's not.
Last year was a difficult year for most of us. For all of us in the Harper community, you know, and the freshmen may not know, but we lost 3 students last year.
This is actually underplaying the bad news. Last year, 21 kids, current and recent Harper students, were wounded by gunshots. 5 recent students died. And that is all on top of the 3 current students that Ms. Sanders mentioned. Total, 29 shot, 8 of them dead.
But we know that their spirits are with us. So right now, I just want to ask for a moment of silence for Marcus Nunn, Cedric Bell, and Shikaki Aspi right now.
Watching this, it's hard not to think that if you grafted these facts onto another high school in a wealthier place, maybe a suburb, dozens of students shot, 3 of them killed. In other places, that would be national news, right? We would all know the name of that school. It's worth noting that this is a gym filled with hundreds of teenagers who this very same morning have been asked over and over to be quiet and who, like most teenagers, haven't exactly jumped to. When this moment comes, nothing moves.
Praise God.
And then high school resumes.
You know, I know you get the question a lot about how the show is changing over time or anyway evolving. And one of the things that you've been doing a lot more of over the past, at least my sense of it, over the past, you know, 5-6 years or whatever, are these bigger investigative pieces. Is that a kind of change for you in some ways? And did you expect that this is where the show would head in those earlier days?
I didn't expect the show would head this way at all. I mean, partly because our early shows, the format was designed to be something that we could produce on the cheap.
Yeah.
And so the early shows, a typical episode would only pretend to be a documentary show. But in fact, what we were doing is there would be a story by a writer like David Sedaris or Sarah Vowell. So that's, you know, they would work for cheap for us, you know, like we were just lucky, like they would work for cheap and, you know, and then it's not that much work. Like one producer can in a week, like work with a writer and get the thing, you know, polished for radio and adapted for radio and get them recorded and add some music underneath. Like it's easy to produce a David Sedaris story because he's so great. You know, it's not that much work. And so that's one piece. And then another piece would be just basically I would interview somebody for an hour or two and then we would edit it into, you know, something that would be 20 minutes on the air where somebody would come in and tell a story.
Yeah.
And so you could do that in a day or two of work. And then there might be one thing where somebody would go out in the field. So really you were doing like one 10-minute produced piece. And that those are the, you know, just for somebody listening, that's the really labor-intensive stuff where you go out and you record 10 or 20 or 30 hours of tape. And then you have to go through the tape and listen to it and select and structure. And like that's super labor-intensive. So in the early days of the show, we you know, the format prevented us from doing more ambitious reporting because we were such a small staff. It was me and three people and that was it. And now it's, you know, it's me and 11 people, you know, as it became possible to get underwriting and to get funding for the show that was at a higher level and, you know, people donating to their local public radio stations, which, you know, now we're on over 500 stations and a small part of that gets passed on to us. Like, I feel like, well, we have money and we should use it. Really after September 11th, we started getting more interested in the news and wanted to make that part of our mission and basically tackle the news the way we had been doing personal stories before that. Like in the early days of the show was consciously designed as applying the tools of journalism to stories that are so small and personal, journalists wouldn't touch them. And then after September 11th, we and everyone in the country became much more interested in the news, I think. And the story selection followed our interest. And because that's the only way any show is any good anyway, is if the staff is like, you know, actually just following what it's actually interested in. And then we wanted to do stories in our style, but about the news. So there'd be characters and scenes and funny moments and emotional moments and real story arcs and plot arcs. Like so the stories are still like little movies for radio, but they happen to be about the news now.
But I wonder if, like a few years ago, you had to retract this story that was this piece by Mike Daisy. He had done it by going to China. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about what you learned from that experience in the sense that I guess what I'm wondering is if you feel like that now that you're doing more investigative pieces or stuff that's more focused on, you know, news, if you have to be rigorous in a way that you hadn't really expected to be or thought of, which isn't to say that This American Life hasn't always been rigorous or about journalism, but do you worry that the kind of fact-checking that you have to go through could, you know, limit creativity of certain stories, you know, particularly the personal pieces like David Sedaris or Mike Birbiglia. Do you know what I mean?
That story, the Mike Daisy story that we ended up retracting, he's not a journalist. He's somebody who had gone to China on his own and was telling the story of it in a monologue on stage. And I went and saw the monologue and thought, this is really – he's saying a lot of stuff I hadn't known. And he says that it's true. And like I met with him and said, like, look, you know, if this is all true, like we'd want to put it on our show.
I talk to an older man with leathery skin. His right hand is twisted up into a claw. It was crushed in a metal press at Foxconn. He says he didn't receive any medical attention and it healed this way. And then when he was too slow, they fired him. Today he works at a woodworking plant. He says he likes it better. He says the people are nicer and the hours are more reasonable. He works about 70 hours a week. And I ask him what he did when he was at Foxconn, and he says he worked on the metal enclosures for the laptops, and he worked on the iPad. And when he says this, I reach into my satchel, and I take out my iPad, and when he sees it, his eyes widen, because one of the ultimate ironies of globalism, at this point, there are no iPads in China. Even though every last one was made at factories in China, they've all been packaged up in perfectly minimalist Apple packaging and then shipped across the seas so that we can all enjoy them. He's never actually seen one on this thing that took his hand. I turn it on, unlock the screen, and pass it to him. He takes it. The icons flare into view, and he strokes the screen with his ruined hand. And the icons slide back and forth. And he says something to Kathy. And Kathy says, he says, it's a kind of magic.
We went through a long fact-checking process with him, actually, where the one thing we didn't do is we weren't able to reach his translator. And then somebody else, after we broadcast it, reached the translator, found the translator, who said, like, none of these incidents didn't happen. Like, the things that he's documenting about Apple and the way its products are made are true, but he did not witness it himself. And so you know, in the wake of that like, since then, we now hire outside fact checkers. Like, we were always very, very careful.
Yeah.
And always, you know, at the level that you are with all, you know, all the programs on public radio. I came to do this after being a producer and a reporter for All Things Considered and Morning Edition. And, you know, those are very carefully made shows. But generally, the way the fact checking has worked out is that the editor and the reporter just talk through any areas where anything is hazy, and they talk through anything. But now we have outside fact checkers, which is an incredible thing, where we have people who are outsiders who basically re-report the entire story, every story. And to get to the thing that's at the heart of your question, like, what does that do to creativity? What it does is that I just feel bad, because sometimes there'll be a story that somebody told, like, on stage at the Moth as a funny story. And they'll submit it to us, and we'll be like, that's really an awesome story. And now we're going to call your dad, who you haven't spoken with in 15 years, your estranged family, to be sure that this really happened. And so we've had to do that. And people, it's really uncomfortable.
You confronted Mike, of course, on the show. Were you pissed?
I mean, I wish I had this sort of personality where I could get mad in that very unambiguous way. I mean, I felt really sad, because I like Mike Daisy and I like his work, and I liked working with him and putting together the radio piece that we did. Adapting the stage piece to radio was really a big job. And, we had spent days together working, and I really enjoyed him. And was I mad? I mean, I'm not so in touch with my own anger that I feel like I even know when it's happening, which has been an issue in other areas of my life that maybe you're outside the range of this interview. But so I guess I was at some level, I guess. But the thing I was mostly feeling was it seemed sad.
Yeah.
The whole thing seemed sad. I felt like I felt bad that this person I liked and I were going through this, and now we're in these roles with each other. You know, I might be more inclined to believe you, but you admit to lying about so many little things, the number of people who you spoke to, the number of factories that you visited. You admit to making up an entire group of characters who didn't exist, who were poisoned by hexane, and the only person who was with you said these things didn't happen. And so when it comes to, you know, the underage workers and the man with the claw hand, it's like, I don't believe that that happened.
All I can tell you is that I stand by what I told you before, that I stand by those things.
That those things happen, the specific things.
And I stand by it as a theatrical work. I stand by how it makes people see and care about the situation that's happening there. I stand by it in the theater, and I regret deeply that it was put into this context on your show.
Are you going to change the way that you label this in the theater? so that the audience in the theater knows that this isn't, strictly speaking, a work of truth, but in fact what they're seeing is really a work of fiction that has some true elements in it.
Well, I don't know that I would say in a theatrical context that it isn't true. But I believe that when I perform it in a theatrical context in the theater, that when people hear the story in those terms, that we have different languages for what the truth means.
I understand that you believe that, but I think you're kidding yourself in the way that normal people who go to see a person talk, people take it as a literal truth. I thought the story was literally true, seeing it in the theater. Brian, who's seen other shows of yours, thought all of them were true. I saw your nuclear show. I thought that was completely true. Like I thought it was true because you were on stage saying, this happened to me. I took you at your word.
A couple of years ago, you went on the Marc Maron podcast, WTF. I was listening to it again this week. What do you think about the podcast, Marc Maron? And I guess I'm thinking more generally, not just that one, but the other kinds of styles of interview, because I listen from time to time, like Howard Stern, for example, and Marc Maron, people who do interviews that are not in the least bit public radio-y. Like what you make of what's out there, you know, beyond the public radio universe?
I mean, I like and respect Marc Maron's podcast. That's why I wanted to be on it.
Yeah.
and enjoyed being on it. And he's a great interviewer. And being interviewed by him reminded me of something that I think I sometimes forget, which is that the reason why he's a good interviewer is because when you're talking to him, he is so emotionally present, and he's just so right there with you, and he's sitting close to you, and he's looking you in your eyes, and he is so revealing of his true feelings all the time, just as a person, that you feel like you have to rise to his level of being real. Like you can't just say the blah 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 that often happens in an interview. And it's funny because my mentor Keith, who taught me about documentary production, always used to say that an interview is a party that you're throwing, and you're the host,
yeah.
And the guests will do what you do. And if you're a stiff, they'll be a stiff. And if you're there, they'll be there. And if you're funny, and if you tell stories, they'll be funny, and they'll tell stories. And I've always kind of known that, right? And they build interviews structurally around that. But like being with Mark, it was one of the most intense times that I really felt like, oh, he's really like a force. And I found myself saying stuff to him that I never find myself saying, just because as a person, when someone is so revealing to you, you want to meet them. Can I say, like, you know, the word that you – the way that you constantly describe yourself is self-involved throughout this whole hour. And I have to say, like, that would totally be the way I would describe myself. That would be the first thing I would say. Like, in talking to people about myself, like you know, in with the people who I'm close to, like I think that would absolutely be the first way I would describe myself. I'm incredibly self-involved, but in some sort of sneaky way, in the guise of being interested in other people. I mean, I actually am deeply interested in other people,
Well, I think
but in my actual life, like what I really am is very self-involved in the project of making the stuff that I like to make.
But I think that we both share the experience of being in conversation, being engaged in these moments on the mic, and in something that is very is it the word visceral and immediate, even if it's scripted. But when you're talking to another individual, that implies, you know, in just by the fact that there's an other there, that those are the moments where, if we are listening, we are not self-involved.
Yeah.
So that is where we live our life.
Yeah.
And I think that the authenticity of what you do when you're in conversation with somebody is what makes the humanness so, you know, palpable and so engaging. And I think that's the beautiful thing about people in general. And I find that when I'm doing it in terms of saying that it helps me in my life, is that when if left to my own devices, if I wasn't in comedy or radio, I think I'd drift away into isolation and just sit and think about shit all the time. And I don't know how much I would talk to other people. I have longer conversations on my show than I have in my real life ever.
Yeah, I do too. I do too. Like a friend once said about me, like, she gets asked, like, what's it like? Like, what am I like in real life? And she's like, well, he's like that, but he never talks to you for that long. And then Howard Stern is one of the best interviewers in broadcasting. Yeah. Like, if you listen to what he does, he gets famous people who don't, who've been interviewed a million times, so they're the hardest people to interview. Yeah. They don't want to say anything.
Yeah.
Everything they say can be bad for business. And he gets them to say stuff that they have never said before, and really revealing stuff. And he really thinks about, what's the thing I really want to know?
Mm-hmm.
Howard really thinks it through in a way, and I respect his judgment about, yeah, like, you know what? That is what I want to know. Like, you've chosen correctly. Like, thank you for doing that. And he's amazing. And Howard's respectful. You, yeah, know, like, he's not mean. He's actually interested in people as people. Yeah, he's just an enormously empathetic, cunning interviewer.
Mm. That's Ira Glass. That's Ira Glass. He's the host of the program This American Life, which you can hear on KUER Saturdays at 3, Sundays at 6. Ira will be at Kingsbury Hall this Saturday night, and there are still a few tickets left. You can go to our website for the details, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Ira Glass, who is coming to Utah on Saturday. We spoke with him last week. You mentioned your mentor, Keith. This was Keith Talbot, who you worked with early on at NPR. This was something,
yeah,
that
I
you
mean, nobody has ever heard of him, but he was on staff at NPR in the 70s, late 70s and early 80s to design new ways to do documentary production and did really beautiful shows.
Keith Talbot was trying all kinds of innovative stuff, and it got you working with Joe Frank, which seemed like kind of a turning point in some way for you because of the emotional sort of capacity of a story or something. And I just wanted you to talk a little bit about that.
Like, I was 19 when I started working at NPR and had never heard NPR on the air. Like, because nobody had heard NPR on the air. It was, right, 1978. They, yeah, had a tiny audience.
Yeah.
They were tiny. And I just sort of heard that this place existed and talked my way into an internship in this place that had, you know, 40 employees or 60 employees or something. Like, it was tiny, tiny, tiny NPR in Washington and two floors of a building. And hearing Joe Frank, like, he's – Joe Frank tells stories on the radio, and he does monologues in the style of, like, old school Gene Shepard. Older people might remember Gene Shepard. And I remember sitting in the studio, like, watching him record his thing and getting so caught up in the story. And, like, this is a weird thing to say, but I had never heard radio that was good. like I totally had the experience of, like, I've never heard anything that's this good. Like, I've never heard somebody on the radio tell a story and I had a sense of suspense and I wanted to find out what was going to happen next, and they had me glued to the radio and I couldn't turn it off.
I was wandering the streets of Soho when I came upon an old, battered 1953 Buick Century four-holer convertible parked at the curb. Although it hadn't been washed for months, it seemed to sparkle like a diamond, It was the most precious, the most desirable, the most infinitely beautiful automobile I had ever seen. And I knew I had to have it. But how could I find the owner? There was a tavern across the street, and on a hunch, I went in and asked the bartender if he might know the driver of the old Buick. He pointed to a young woman sitting alone at the end of the counter, sipping from a stein of beer. I sat down next to her and told her how much I liked her car and offered her $300 for it.
The car isn't for sale.
I said, well, how about $1,000? It isn't worth half as much. Again, she said,
I'm sorry, the car is not for sale.
She asked me why I wanted it so badly.
Is there something about this car I don't know? Is this a collector's item?
And I told her that, for some reason that I couldn't explain, just standing beside it, gazing at it, had charged my life with meaning. I simply had no choice. I had to buy it.
And I had a feeling of, like, we're going somewhere, and I don't know where we're going, and I need to find out where it is. And my feelings were caught up in it, and there was just something about it. I thought, like, I have never heard anything like this. I don't know what this is, but I want to do this. Like, this seems really interesting. And I set about to try to learn it. And it's funny because when we did our 500th episode,
yeah,
like all of us on staff came into the studio and we named a story or something that you know, that we wanted to talk about as, like, one to look back on from the 500 episodes.
Yeah.
And most of the staff, you know, heard our show on the radio before they worked for the show.
Right.
And for a bunch of them, I mean, we didn't use any of these on the air because it seemed too self-aggrandizing. But the story that they wanted to talk about, or at least one of them, was the very first time they heard This American Life, because they had the same experience hearing This American Life that I had heard hearing Joe Frank, of like, oh, I've never heard somebody tell a story on the radio. Mm. Like, that's really interesting to tell a story on the radio. And three or four of them remember exactly where they were and what they were doing. And how they, like, kind of was like, oh my, this is a thing, isn't it? Like, this is a whole thing I didn't know existed, and wanted to do it. Like, they heard it for the first time. They totally had the experience I had.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about our friend David, that show. I wonder, being so personally connected to the subject, if that was difficult at times to do.
Well, this is an episode we did about David Rakoff, yeah, who had been on our show, I think, 25 times, maybe more, and who was a friend,
yeah,
and he died of cancer a year ago, August, and then in the wake of that, we had so many amazing interviews and stories he had done. He had told so much of his life story on our show. We realized that we could tell his whole life from pieces he had made for the show, and it would be incredibly entertaining and also a nice way to remember him. And I had heard that after somebody dies, that it would be possible to have the experience of immersing oneself in their work, or writing about them, or, like, making something about them, and it would affect one's feelings about them. Like, I had heard that that was a thing that could happen, but I didn't think that would ever happen to me. And it totally happened to me. Like, I spent 2 weeks listening to old recordings of David and having to organize them and think about him and write about him. And at the end of those 2 weeks, I felt differently about David. And there had been things that were still unsettled in my feelings about him when he was alive. Just things, the normal things in a friendship and in a work relationship that, you know, moments that you know, weren't settled, that at the end of 2 weeks were totally settled, and like my sense of him had changed. And so it was a really emotional thing to go through in a way that I don't think I've ever experienced in writing or making anything. Since last May, when David performed a dance for the live show that we did, he's been saying that he didn't expect to live past August, and his goal was to finish the book by then. And he said a number of times that he really, really wanted to record the audiobook as well. And so to get that done, quickly enough, he came into the studio here at our show and I recorded him. And there was one section that was just hard to listen to him read. He has one of his characters, Cliff, die of AIDS. And David was dying of cancer as he wrote this section. And in this section, he tries to capture some of what that experience is like.
What a difference a day makes. Now times that by 20. Clifford was hollow, a horn of unplenty, tipping the scales at 115 at most. He was more bone than flesh now, and less man than ghost.
Okay, a word about this recording. David was obviously weak, and the disease had spread to his lungs, which affected his breathing. In this part of the story, Cliff is coming to grips with the certainty that he is on a countdown to his end.
It was sadness that gripped him far more than the fear that if facing the truth, he had maybe a year. When poetic phrases like "eyes look your last" become true, all you want is to stay, to hold fast. A new fierce attachment to all of this world now pierced him. It stabbed like a deity hurled lightning bolt, lancing him, sent from above, left him giddy and tearful. It felt like young love. He'd thought of himself as uniquely proficient at seeing, but now that sense felt insufficient. He wanted to grab, to possess, to devour, to eat with his eyes. How he needed that power. Just like a child whose big gun is a stick, Cliff was now harmless. He'd gotten too sick to take any action beyond rudimentary routines that had shrunk to the most elementary. Which pill to take now, and where is your sweater? Did the Imodium make you feel better? Study your shit to make sure you'd not bled. Make sure the Kleenex is next to the bed. Make sure, be prepared. Plan out every endeavor. Like a scout on the stupidest camping trip ever. The facts were now harder, reality colder, his parasol no match for this falling boulder. And so the concern with the trivial issues, slippers nearby, and the proximate tissues. He thought of those two things in life that don't vary, well, thought only glancingly, more was too scary. Inevitable, why even bother to test it? He'd paid all his taxes, so that left. You guessed it.
I think if you're like a really great writer, maybe you have this all the time with everybody who you ever write about. And I think I'm more of a regular journalist where like I just kind of get in there and I get to know the people and yeah. I write my thing and I don't have as strong a feeling about it. And it's not as transforming for me. And this was the only time.
I know you're truly bored with the question of will radio survive? Not just bored, seemed like I heard I guess it was a Redden interview where the question came up, will radio survive? And you seemed like just remarkably exercised about the idea at all. Just that's just incredibly, I think you said disturbingly nostalgic we tend to be, and that it's just a kind of a boring question.
Well, it's not just a boring question, but who cares if it survives? If it doesn't survive, we'll all be doing something else. If it doesn't survive, like if radio doesn't survive, then we'll all get the news somewhere else. Like it's going to be fine. We're going to be fine. Like all of us who work in radio, we'll find someplace else to make stuff. Like who cares if radio survives? Radio is just who cares? Radio is there for our pleasure, and if it doesn't survive, then we'll all be fine. And What could be more boring? Who cares if it survives? Like, I love radio, but even I don't care. If radio doesn't survive, you know what? I'm going to find something else to do. And I'm going to find another way to, like, something else to listen to in the car in the morning. Like, it's going to be great.
You said also that there's never been a better time to do creative work than right now.
Yes, there's a lot of bad things going on in the world. Global warming is real, and Democrats and Republicans have never been further apart, except for, you know, right leading up to the Civil War. You know, just like there's a lot of bad things. Yeah. You know, Russia is on the march, and you know, there's just like a lot of badness in the world. But one place where things are going great is there has never been a better time to do creative work. Like that part of our culture, we are totally. You know, everything is great. And there's really incredibly wonderful work. The fact that the internet exists means anybody can create work and get it out there, and it can find an audience. And you know, my wife works for a website that her boss is a teenage girl who started being a blogger when she was 11. Her parents didn't know she was a blogger. When she was 12 or 13, her blog was so wonderful. The New York Times wanted to write an article about it and called her up and said, "We want to write an article about your blog." And she's like, "Oh, my parents don't know I do this," and had to tell her parents, you know. And then, and now it's a business, and there's like an army of women, young women and teenage girls, like writing for the stuff, and you know, and it's called Rookie, and it's amazing, and I feel like. That didn't exist. That possibility didn't exist. Or in radio, there was a guy named Roman Mars who does this podcast and radio show called 99% Invisible. It's about design. It's totally wonderful. Yeah. And, you know, he was doing it as kind of a side project. He had other things going on. And then he went to Kickstarter. He needed to raise $35,000. And his listeners, who were not – it was not a lot of listeners. It was like 10 or 15,000 people listened to his thing, gave him – you know, it was a lot of people. But for radio, you know, that's not – that's not a lot. And, you know, they gave him $175,000 and he could quit his day job and this could be his thing. And I don't know, there's just never been a time that's been better to be a young person or an older person and think like, I want to make stuff and I want to try to get it in front of people. And you can do it. You really can do it. And there are all these examples of people who, if you can just make one great thing, one great 3-minute video, 4-minute video, one great radio story. Like that's all you need for people to notice you. And then you can turn it into a job and you can quit your day job. And I mean, maybe not that fast all the time, but do you know what I mean? Like yeah. There's a route, there's a way out. And it didn't used to be that way. And I feel like, you know, like look around us, like TV is incredible and there's great music and like people, like culture is going great. Like, and I think that there's a whole class of people who feel like, oh, things are getting worse and worse and whatever. And I feel like there's so much incredibly wonderful stuff being made all the time. Like none of us ever even has the time to consume all the stuff that we would want to consume if we had the time, you know?
Mm. Ira Glass. Host of the program This American Life, which you can hear Saturdays at 3, Sundays at 6. He's going to be at Kingsbury Hall this Saturday night. There's still a few tickets left. You can go to our website for the particulars, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our technical director is Mike Anderson. Our engineer is Lewis Downey. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Thank you.